From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Comedy in the face of tragedy or of devastation, exactly. That is the Irish. That is the Irish therapy, isn't it?
The spread of ability in a maths class is literally from good old Homer Simpson all the way to Stephen Hawking.
I've been in a dressing room with people and they say, Aoife, no way. And then I'll show them a boot and it's transformational.
Coming up on this wet weekend edition of Playback Daily, discovering, again, how the Irish deal with tragedy. Spoiler alert, with comedy. From Homer to Hawking, the makeup of a modern Irish maths class, and the ultimate dilemma, what shoes go with these jeans? That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that goes with any type of denim. And first up on Playback Daily, it's the morning monologue from Oliver Callan, which today was concerned with some sporting event or other happening over the weekend.
Well, it's all rugby this weekend. Now, there are athletics happening in Holland and the Netherlands, so a big shout out to the big names that were made at the Olympics in Irish Ganzies, and they're taking part in the European Indoor Championships. We'll be expecting medals, and hopefully after the weekend we'll be talking in a very upbeat fashion. But since it is, by the way, Seachtain na Gaeilge weather, your must-use phrase for the Géire Seachtain at the weekend is an Cathréim Mhór, which is the Grand Slam as Gaeilge, an Cathréim Mhór. Vuig siad an Cathréim Mhór sa rugby. They won the Grand Slam. So that's your phrase now for the week ahead.
If Ireland don't beat France, now you know who jinxed it. On to the North American conflict that's been raging since January 20th and some amusing Canadian messaging.
They have been removing Jack Daniels and American spirits off the shelves in fury at what are momentary tariffs. Some of the tariffs have been lifted. It's very confusing what's going on. But mostly fury at the collapse of relations between the US and its northern frenemy, I suppose you can call them now. I was reading even a phone call between Donald Trump and Justin Trudeau on Wednesday descended into profanities, according to the Wall Street Journal. So the Canadians are mad as hell. They're not going to take it anymore. And I'm talking about the plan to annex the North American independent state and also proud member of the British Commonwealth as well, with French-speaking natives and, of course, natives. So back in the year 2000, to set the context for what's happening over there now, Molson Beer, Canadian lager brand, made a famous advert. It featured a man called Canadian Joe, and he's walking onto a stage to declare his heritage against stereotypes, and it ramped up like this.
Hey, I'm not a lumberjack or a fur trader, and I don't live in an igloo or eat blubber or own a dog sled, and I don't know Jimmy, Sally, or Susie from Canada, although I'm certain they're really, really nice. I have a prime minister, not a president. I speak English and French, not American, and I pronounce it about, not a boot. I can proudly sew my country's flag on my backpack. I believe in peacekeeping, not policing, diversity, not assimilation, and that the beaver is a truly proud and noble animal.
You go, Canadians. So that was the year 2000, 25 years ago, and so now they've come in the new world order they live in. They've redone it, and it's gone very big. It's the same guy, 25 years on, actor Jeff Douglas is his name, and it's a repudiation of the American direction and its plans for what the Americans are calling the 51st state. Give it to them, Canadians.
They mistake our modesty for meekness, our kindness for consent, our nation for another star on their flag, and our love of a hot, cheesy poutine with their love of a hot, cheesy Putin. They think they can bully us, threaten us, and push us around, but they do not know us. Are we perfect?
Stirring stuff. That's what the sort of level we want at the rugby tomorrow. And comedy can make a very good point, can't it? Yes, and the relations continue to have a certain frisson in the air and so on.
Those moose-riding Canucks are pretty funny, aren't they? Hope they're still laughing if this long global nightmare ever ends. And a little closer to home, there was a British-Irish summit in Liverpool on Thursday, which Oliver couldn't help but scrutinise.
Did you notice the class photograph that they published around the beautiful polished table with all the top people from both countries, two leaders, Taoiseach, two deputy prime ministers, both of the energy ministers, they're there because of the wind announcements, two justice ministers, two ambassadors to each state. And then I noticed Education Minister Helen McEntee, who we've seen, she's Minister of Europe in the past and she was Justice before, but there was no opposite number. There was no UK Education Secretary. And I thought, that's a bit odd. And then it kind of dawned on me, a theory, because the Irish delegation of Taoiseach, Taoiseach, Minister for Justice, the Energy Minister, Ambassador to London, the Secretary General of the Department of Taoiseach, are all men, all of the men. So it appeared, maybe, just for the cameras, that they flew in Helen McEntee and they put her right next to the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, is because we're so lacking in gender balance at the top. So the Canadians wouldn't allow it, for sure. And it was International Women's Day. I just thought it was it stood out because on the British side, no such issue there. Their Deputy Prime Minister and Home Secretary are women, Angela Rayner and Yvette Cooper. And on the news last night, I thought it would start because you could see the EU Summit of Leaders and the obviously European Commission President is a woman, Ursula von der Leyen, and a clip from the Danish leader who's a woman. And I just thought we look a bit backward when you see Ireland under the bright lights of the world stage. I know there are three women in cabinet and in prominent roles too, but none of them in roles that kind of end up on the world stage. So maybe somebody in government buildings realised this would look bad and they flew over the education minister, to kind of fill that space, I suppose. Welcome to the 70s. We're a bit scarlet looking at it.
We really are the bestest little country to be a woman in, aren't we? Meanwhile, in Denmark, they're taking a step that would have Kevin Costner raging at them. Can we be far behind?
The Danish Postal Service have said they're going to deliver their last letter at the end of this year, focusing only on packages. No more letters, which means no more letter boxes. PostNord have said they're going to cut 1,500 jobs in the country and remove 1,500 symbolic red, they're symbolic but also practical, the red post boxes, saying there's increasing digitalisation of society and this thing is over. The Danish Postal Service has been responsible for delivering letters in the country since 1624. That is 400 years. But since the year 2000, the number of letters has fallen by 90%. And they said this is not sustainable anymore. There's been market liberalisation in Denmark. So we've lost financial support. And just to cut costs, we have to. That's it. 30th of December. It's the last letter ever being delivered there. Now, postal services are struggling around Europe. By the way, the government of Denmark said, oh, it'll still be possible to post letters in some places, but it's just going to be fewer and fewer spots. But they're removing a hell of a lot of post boxes. And it's a kind of extraordinary moment in their history. Postal services are struggling across Europe due to the same thing, digitalisation, because of the emails have obviously removed the letters. And the German postal service, Deutsche Post, announced also yesterday that it's going to cut 8,000 jobs in Germany. The core letters business in the British Royal Mail has been ravaged as well. They're proposing that Royal Mail deliver letters on alternate weekdays instead of every day to save them millions of pounds. Mind you, I thought Post in Ireland had turned a corner because they had Amazon, they've been delivering packages basically for online and so on, basically. That's the story of the postal letters. A sad story, I would say. A sad one.
Always good to end on a sad note, I feel. The slow death of anything that isn't made up of ones and zeros continues. And with that profound thought, we leave the monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan and look forward to Monday's triumphant Told You So or Meek Apology. There's a new regulator in town. Anne-Marie Caulfield is the CEO of the Gambling Regulatory Authority of Ireland. Claire Byrne spoke to the new CEO and first Anne-Marie set out what types of gambling are covered by the new authority.
So it's all forms of gambling. So betting, both on-site and online. It will be gaming, both on-site and online, and also lotteries.
But not the national lottery.
But not the national lottery, indeed. That's not part of our remit. So in addition to the gambling to consumers, it'll also be gambling will be licensed with us, business to business, I should say. So companies, for example, who program for games online and so on will have a license with us, and also companies who provide, say, the machinery that you would see in an amusement arcade, they'll also be licensed with us again to ensure that they're technically operating to appropriate standards.
Now, there's a huge challenge because just this week we saw that estimate that there are 130,000 people who could have issues, gambling addictions in this country. It's a huge number, isn't it?
It is a huge number. That was the first piece of research that we commissioned with the ESRI, and it came out at 10 times higher than had previously been thought. So 1 in 30 people, or 3.3% of the Irish population, have, you know, significant gambling harms in their lives.
And there's very little available to them in terms of treatment. I know the Rutland opened up a programme which can take 26 people a year on a residential programme. We have huge deficits in that area, don't we?
Yes, I heard with great interest that interview with the Rutland Centre. There are a number of areas that you can receive treatment. If you go to www.grai.ie, we launched a new website this week. And so there's a number of different facilities that do provide with gambling treatment. I suppose the other thing is there's other assistance there in terms of blocking apps on your phone, blocking apps on your PC that we have listed there. Also in terms of some of the banks, AIB has introduced where if you want to block payments to gambling companies, they can do that. They have a dedicated line for that now. Revolut have it, and we're working with other banks. We're hopeful that they'll be able to do the same very soon.
But in terms of funding treatment and expanding treatment, what role will the regulatory authority have in that regard, if any?
So one of the things that we will be doing is setting up a social impact fund. We'll be entirely self-financing ourselves, but this is above and beyond that. So it's a levy which will be placed on all operators. The minister will decide on the extent of that levy. In some countries it's 1%, in some countries it's 2%. And that will be set aside for things like research, education and awareness, and put towards the treatment of addictions to gambling.
So that levy is separate to the fee that these companies will pay to the regulator, which eventually, when they all come on board as they're renewing their licences, you'll become self-funding through that fee. Is that right?
That's right.
Levy then is separate to that?
The levy is separate. It's a social impact fund to address the adverse impact of gambling and to assist people in the scenarios that you've described, and also for education and awareness.
And what rates are those levies and fees set at?
So we have done extensive work in the background. We've reached out to other regulators right across Europe in relation to this, and also have taken legal advice. And we have a proposal to put to the minister now. Our seven-person authority was just appointed a couple of days ago, so we need them to review it and then onwards to the minister. We do have a process to go through in terms of consultations on them as well.
So they haven't been set yet, is it, or decided on yet?
No, they haven't been set, but we have done a lot of work in terms of what would make us self-financing and what would be necessary to fund the social impact fund.
Okay, now one of the big changes would be around advertising betting, isn't that right? There is a form of ban in place at the moment, Emery, isn't there?
The ban will come into place when entities are licensed, and that ban will apply then from 5:30 in the morning till 9 at night. And just to remind people why that's been introduced, it's to protect children from gambling advertising and the adverse impact of gambling. It's estimated that if you start gambling as a child, you're twice as likely to develop an issue with gambling harm in later life. So it's important to protect children. So that's one of the restrictions.
So we will see ads during that period as all of these entities come up for licensing. Is that right?
That's correct. It is attached to your obligations as a licensed entity. So it will be as they're licensed. We have designed our licensing regime. We are building our ICT systems at the moment, and we would hope to open for licensing on a phased basis, because there are licenses out there and we will have to coordinate with our colleagues in revenue, for example. Later this year, though, we hope to open for a license.
And this covers online as well, online ads, right?
It does indeed. And indeed, in terms of, you know, cross-selling, for example, companies, say, for example, if somebody's betting on horse racing or on football, they won't be allowed to push them ads for online casinos or online slots and so on. Mm-hmm. Because again, that's, you know, something that that multiple forms of gambling introduces particular dangers and harms.
But if you have an online company that is operating out of another country but selling into Ireland, so it mightn't be regulated in Ireland in that sense, or how does that work and how can you control those situations?
Okay, so first and foremost, if you're operating in Ireland, regardless of where you're based, you must be licensed with us. That's
okay.
A legal obligation.
So you can't take money from anybody here without being licensed in Ireland. Is that
you must be licensed in Ireland. Now, obviously, we'll have to be very vigilant about the black market activity. In the first instance, I suppose, education and awareness, because, like, you know, to give your account details to an unlicensed entity would be a very unsafe thing to do. You don't know where they will end up. Whereas the entities licensed with us, financial checks would be one of the three pillars of checks we will put them through before they get a license.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose that's the first thing. The second thing is we will be scanning with software to identify unlicensed entities and to take them down. And we're looking at a whole range of measures. We just have a director of enforcement has started with us 3 weeks ago. But a whole range of measures in terms of, you know, collaboration with other regulators, collaboration with social media providers and so on.
So your enforcement team will be in-house with you, with the regulator under that function?
So we have a head of enforcement at the moment appointed with very considerable experience previously with the DPP and the Office of Corporate Enforcement in-house. We also have a legal team. We've procured that as one of the areas that we've set up. But we'll also collaborate closely with An Garda Síochána, with the DPP and with other entities, other regulators.
Okay.
We are signing MOUs with them across Europe as well.
That's the CEO of the new Gambling Regulatory Authority of Ireland, Anne-Marie Caulfield, talking to Claire Byrne this morning. On this afternoon's Liveline, Joe Duffy heard from Brian Merriman, who wanted to talk about Riverdance playing the Kennedy Center in Washington, given that organization's new self-appointed chairman.
Joe, I'm quite sad to read that I knew that Donald Trump had fired all the good people in the Kennedy Center in America and taken over himself as the chairman of it, as if he hasn't enough to do. But I was very sad to read that one of our greatest cultural ambassadors, Riverdance, is playing there this week and next week. And I think at a time when artists are being silenced and cancelled, not for their quality art, the lack of it, of their art, but just for their perceived political views, I think it's a really, really dangerous moment in the arts that we must make sure that we don't reward artistic or political activity like that within the arts. So I was very, very disappointed. A month after he's taken over, he can look now at the March returns and go, oh, no difference. The place was packed. Everybody had a great time and it was business as usual. It's not business as usual. People and events and artists are being fired or cancelled, and others like Hamilton the musical are now cancelling on them in return. So we're in a very dangerous spot, I think, at the moment for the arts, and it's important that we are responsible for all our actions.
So you want Riverdance, who are currently on in the Kennedy Center in Washington, I presume they're sold out, it's St. Patrick's Week, and they're beginning another world tour, 30th anniversary. You want the young people in Riverdance to walk off the stage?
No, I wouldn't say that.
Well, what do you want them to do?
What I want them to do is to be accountable for endorsing...
What does that mean?
Right. I think what it means is this, is that, for example, the Kennedy Center was started by President Eisenhower as a nonpartisan artistic mm-hmm. center, went on to be called after John F. Kennedy. And actually, it was actually opened by Nixon, right, who was not a swinging liberal. OK, but over all the years, it has managed to accommodate and to celebrate in the Kennedy Honors diversity, all kinds of different artists, and never to censor what goes on the stage. Suddenly, you know, a week into his presidency, mm-hmm. he fires all the chief executives, he fires all the board replaces them with donors and their spouses, etc. And the first thing to go was the World Pride event and the Gay Men's Chorus. They were fired and told that their event was cancelled. Then a children's musical, which has won a Helen Hayes Award, called Finn, about a young shark, you know, feeling a bit different but wanting to stay in the family. That's the next thing to go. Who did the artistic appraisal?
I don't know who did the artistic appraisal, but that's not what you're talking about. You want the young people of Riverdance, which has been going under different troupes every year, and thousands have gone through and travelled the world and been paid employment. You want them to walk off the stage this evening, or not go on the stage or whatever, as a protest against Donald Trump.
No, and I don't know where you got that from.
I just got it from you.
No, you
didn't. What do you want Riverdance to do?
I want Riverdance, right, which is a fantastic organisation, great employers, right, and really do an awful lot to show about how culture is shared by so many groups. Like, for example, in Riverdance, there's Spanish dancing, there's American Catholic.
Please answer the question,
Joe, but you're making it too simplistic.
What do you want Riverdance to do? They're on the stage in 5 hours.
Explain to people why they believe that the current Kennedy Center is an appropriate place for them to celebrate their wonderful work and their cultural diversity.
Because I presume, I have a concern. Because they booked it 2, 3, 4 years ago.
Joe, you can find another center and another stage anywhere you like.
So they should cancel.
Like Hamilton cancelled. Hamilton,
don't bring Hamilton are on Broadway. Hamilton is on the West End. Hamilton is $200 to go in and see it, or whatever you probably. Hamilton is hardly a bereft business enterprise looking for platforms. They're on the go all over the world.
And Riverdance 30 years isn't either.
Hamilton,
30 years, the longest running show in the world.
What's wrong with that? Congratulations!
Brilliant.
Yeah,
I do.
What do you want them to do?
What I think what they'd need to do in relation to their current artistic policy is to look exactly at their actions and what they have done by going on that stage for this fortnight without comment. I don't know if they've
have you been on to them for comment?
No.
Why didn't you get on to them for comment?
Because
you're founder of the Dublin Gay Theatre Festival.
That's right.
Your background is public relations, I think, going way back. Why didn't you get onto Riverdance and ask them why?
Because this is a wider discussion. It is not just about, at the moment, Riverdance are the example, but it is about all artistic groups considering who they're going to collaborate with and what they're going to associate with and the cost of that endorsement. Because at the moment, when you look at the March figures for the Kennedy Center, after what Trump did there and all the people he's cancelled, made unemployed, etc., there will be no difference in the takings for therefore. Therefore, if he's not stopped on the first list, will this time next year you and I be talking about the fact that now no Irish performers can perform on American stages because Trump doesn't like us?
Did you by any chance? Because you used to be, I think, press director of the Combat Poverty Agency years ago. So you're well versed in this business. Did you ring the Kennedy Center and ask them what would be the implications of Riverdance pulled out?
No, I didn't, because it's not my business to interfere in the contract of people.
Well, exactly. Well, can I put another question? Given that you now run drama productions or whatever, do you not think Riverdance to pull out of a contract that they obviously signed years ago, before Donald Trump was even elected? Do you think that if they pulled out today, in the most litigious country in the world, they would not be sued for every penny and every costume they have by the Kennedy Center?
That my solution, and that I have asked them to pull out of this, and I haven't.
Asked them to do?
Now, Joe, this is a serious matter of censorship.
You're on Liveline, yes.
Yes, but you're in the
media.
You're
the fourth item on Liveline. You're not being censored.
Exactly.
You're on your own.
No, you're not hearing me.
It's my job to ask you. You don't want them to pull out?
No. I think at this stage, what I want them to do is to look at the consequences of their actions.
right? Which means that they have gone in to a centre which is now censoring artistic expression. Would they do that? Should they do that? And what are their next steps when they go on further tours? I mean, it is really astonishing that people would find it difficult to understand that their fellow artists are being fired and cancelled because of their perceived political opinions.
Well, that escalated kind of quickly. Brian Merriman there, debating with Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about the Trump takeover of the Kennedy Center for the Arts in Washington and Riverdance performing there as part of their latest tour. Two weeks ago, to mark Ireland Reads, Oliver Callan put out a call for reluctant readers or people who fell out of the habit of reading, and that's how they came across Ronan McDermott, who they challenged to pick up a book again. He told Oliver how he got on reading Rachel's Holiday by Marion Keyes.
Tell us a little bit about yourself or your stage in life, Ronan, if you don't mind, to begin with.
I took early retirement just actually around the time of the COVID. So I had lots of plans for travel and so forth at the time. Of course, they all got scuppered. So one of the things I did was I got into walking. So every day I'd go out for a couple of hours walking and got into podcasts. And then through that, I got into audiobooks because obviously they lend themselves to, you know, activity when you're doing walking or going to the gym and things like that. So big fan of that. But I got out of the habits of reading books.
Right.
You can't multitask when you're reading a book. Well, I can't anyway.
No, not many people can. Were you a big reader in the past?
Oh, way back I was, yeah. Even from childhood, I was a voracious reader of books. And I feel like it's a habit. So I took the opportunity at the invitation of your show to try and spur myself back into action, to try and see if I could rekindle the actual physical habit of the real book. I have a stack of books I've been given for presents
right?
I haven't opened. It's embarrassing.
I'd say a load of people, you shouldn't be embarrassed at all, by the way, because this would be common to so many people. Do you remember how you fell out of the habit or what might have been the cause?
Well, I think just it's the probably time. Mm-hmm. I remember studying a lot. At one stage, I was doing a course, and there was a huge reading content in the course, and I think it kind of spoilt my appetite for reading, just because you're reading, you know, when you're studying, you're reading for function, you're reading to get information, to reproduce it in some way, whereas, you know, reading a book is about joy and pleasure. So it kind of spoiled my appetite a little bit for it that way. But I still like books and stories, and, you know, I do enjoy the audiobooks.
Was the last audiobook you tuned into?
Well, I just finished one called Carla's Choice, which which was written by the son of John le Carré.
We had him on,
It's actually his brilliant book altogether. And before that, I had Remembering Sinead O'Connor's amazing biography. I mean, it's the saddest, funniest book I ever read.
You've got great taste.
Horrendous, but she tells it with such humour.
Extraordinary. You've got good taste. So we set you the challenge 2 weeks ago to read Rachel's Holiday, a massive blockbuster bestseller by the great Marion Keyes, of course. And it's a fairly big enough book. How did you get on?
Well, confession to make. First of all, I found the book. I'm finding the book. I haven't finished it, first of all.
Yeah.
I haven't finished it. But I like her style. I described the book to me. It was like a clever silliness. So the opening, you know, sections of the book are, you know, she's living in New York and up to divilment. And, you know, it's almost like slapstick humour. Every line has humour in it. But then the book sort of gets deeper and deeper and becomes a more substantial piece of work. But some of the funny stuff, like I was thinking, like she's talking about baking with desecrated coconuts, you know, and she's talking about weight loss. She about to call it. She says, maybe I got lucky enough to swallow a tapeworm to explain her weight loss. You know, so every line is peppered with funny stuff like that. But as I've got more and more into it, it's getting deeper and deeper into her. She, obviously, there's an addiction at the root of the whole thing.
That's right.
And the encounter sessions in the cloisters, which is the clinic she's in, the encounter sessions are, they kind of start off funny, but then they kind of get into the nub of the matter. And it's actually terrific, actually, the way she does it.
So you found yourself immersed in this, even though you... How many pages did you get through in the end?
I'm currently... I've probably... about 300 pages, 350. So plowing my way through.
You enjoyed it and you're going to continue?
Well, I'm determined to finish the book, absolutely. Yeah, I must say, I'm getting more hooked, actually, as I'm getting deeper into it. In fairness, so but she's a terrific writer. Like it, she has a real light touch. The sentences just flow, and you know, she's. I can't get over like in a page you could have 15 jokes or 15 witty comments or something like that. You know, so I heard you should get the volume of material.
She's still doing it. There's a great sequel.
Yeah, I was looking at the back of the book. There's about 20 of these books, and they're all one as good as the next.
Kamir, you as a when you were reading and buying books and picking them up to read for yourself, you probably may not have picked up a Marion Keyes because not many men do.
No, I wouldn't have. This is well out of my wheelhouse, in fairness. I wouldn't have. And the cerise pink cover on the book wouldn't have caught my eye at all in the bookshop, you know. But yeah. I'm glad I got the chance to do something that's a bit different, something that I wouldn't have normally. You know, wouldn't have normally approached or had a go at. So I can appreciate, like, she is a fine writer, as well as it being a fine book. So it's been a good opportunity for
me. But you can tell now what the men have been missing out on all this time.
Well, I can, the bottom line is she's very funny. That's the thing. You know, I've read a book years ago, Vernon Got Little. I don't know if people would know that one.
Yeah, won the Booker Prize.
Yeah, and it reminds me of that, or this kind of person who constantly things are befalling them that are, you know, potentially their own fault, but this constant humour underneath this, or glazing over this tragedy, you know, or if you like things like Bad Sisters or Aisling Beattie, that thing, was it This Way Up?
Yeah.
A year or two ago, where you got this, I suppose maybe it's an Irish sense of humour, I'm not sure.
It is, it's kind of comedy in the face of actual
comedy in
devastation.
The face of tragedy or of devastation, exactly. That is the Irish therapy, isn't it?
Because, of course, Vernon Got Little is the American book, and it's about, I think it's a school mass killings, isn't there? But we're in the head
it's
of the
horrendous.
Character.
Yeah, it's horrendous, yeah. Down in Texas or somewhere like
That's
that,
right.
You know. The family are embarrassing, and, you know, the young fella's constantly being embarrassed by everything.
It's really good. Have we changed your life now, Ronan McDermott?
Well, you've opened it. I'm 20 minutes a day reading that I wasn't doing until very recently, you know, so you've got 20 minutes a day of a change anyway, that's something.
And you're going to stick at it?
I'm going to finish the book, that's for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of feel like that's the least he could do, right? That's visiting critic Ronan McDermott, rediscovering the joys of reading on this morning's Oliver Callan. Back on Today with Claire Byrne, and there was a discussion with Brendan Gilday, maths teacher and author, and Carl O'Brien, the education editor of the Irish Times this morning, on the Leaving Cert and how reports are suggesting that grade inflation might this year turn into grade deflation. While there was also talk about the merits of the bonus point system for honours maths. Here's Carl on the painful process of unwinding the grade inflation put in place during the pandemic.
The Leaving Cert grades have been hugely inflated compared to normal times for about 5 years. And that started, as you said, in the pandemic. We had these teacher predicted grades that were very generous. And so students were, in recent years, have been scoring about 60 CO points higher than they would have done if they sat the exams prior to the pandemic. And there's been a political decision to keep these grades at these high levels for Leaving Certs out of fairness. And that fairness is really about the CO points race, because students in any given year are competing for a limited number of college places with applicants from results from previous years. So now we are seeing the new Minister for Education, Helen McEntee, is planning to progress with measures to restore these grades back to normal. So in terms of what did that look like? Well, it's planned that the results will still be inflated this summer, but they'll be inflated at a lower level. So, for example, last year, results were artificially inflated once they were marked by an average of about 7.5%. This year, it's planned that they'll be inflated by around 5.5%. So that works out, by my calculation anyway, roughly at about the student might lose 15 or 16 Leaving Cert points or CO points compared to last year for the same results. So that is, of course, controversial, because these students from the class of 2025 will be competing with candidates on bumper grades from recent years, and that does raise this issue of unfairness for the class of 2025.
If I was a canny student of 2021 and I had waited and waited for this to happen with my nicely inflated results in hand, I have a distinct advantage now in 2025, don't I?
You do, absolutely. And interestingly, you know, this year, this particular year, we've seen a record number of CEO applications. Now, we don't know yet what is behind that. Is that down to more students with these bumper results from previous years opting to apply with this, if you like, golden ticket that they have? Or indeed, as some think it might be, is it just more students from abroad opting to apply to study in Ireland? We actually won't know for about another week as to what is behind this big increase in CEO applications. But certainly, you know, this does give rise to a lot of stress for students facing into the exams on top of what is already obviously a very difficult experience. The Leaving Cert is tough and a pressure cooker of exams in any year.
Well, it had long been predicted that there would be litigation over this. Is that what you would expect to see?
It's certainly being discussed at senior levels. There's a concern that if you do have a student who misses out on a college place and they may have missed out because a student from previous years got it ahead of them, that could certainly give rise to potential for litigation. Now, there were concerns when they introduced these inflated grades back in 2020 and 2021, because the people who were being disadvantaged then were the students from previous years, because if you like, their results were suddenly devalued because then the new class had higher grades. Now, there weren't, as I understand, there wasn't litigation then, but that doesn't mean that there won't be this time around. So there's certainly a sense of nervousness about it. But what everyone does acknowledge is the need to restore the grades back to more normal levels. And there's a few reasons for that. You know, one is that we've had so many high grades and so this bunching of students with top results that it's made it very difficult for universities to differentiate between the top candidates for these really high points courses like medicine and pharmacy. So that's one issue. And the other is it's just unfair for particularly students from places like Northern Ireland, where the grades have gone back to normal and they're disadvantaged in a race where they're competing with students on inflated grades.
Right. Yeah. OK, it's painful but needed. Carl O'Brien, Education Editor with the Irish Times. Now, we're going to talk maths with Brendan Gilday, who's here in front of me in the studio. But before we do, I mean, do you agree with that they have to come down, but it isn't going to be nice for some?
No, it's very complicated. And I think everybody agrees that it needs to come down. I don't know. I mean, just as a sort of a side story, last year and in the last few years, students are able to view their papers, and rightly so, openness and transparency. But last year, I was asked to look at a young man's paper. He got a H6 in higher maths and he was very unhappy. He thought he was worth more. I went and viewed the paper with him online. And when we looked at the paper, he'd actually been given 28% and post-marking intervention, that great phrase from Adolf Huxley, maybe or some Soviet era plan, he was lifted up to 41% just on that. That's a
huge. That is great inflation. Now, that's what it looks
absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely. So he just then said, oh, thank you, Brendan. I won't be appealing. Right. I said, I think that's a very good idea. And so that, I'm sure, is quite common all around the country.
Yeah, but see, the problem is when, you know, someone who has that level of grade inflation goes into a course at third level and finds that they can't cope with it. They can't do it.
For sure. And I think that we're well seeing that, and that's been the case for a few years, because colleges have been putting on extra maths, in particular in all kinds of colleges all around the country, to try and cope with that. We've had this problem's been long standing, but I think now with this grade inflation being acknowledged and they're trying to pare back on it, there's a. And then the bonus points been getting dimension then as well.
Listen, let's come to that, because, I mean, this figure is extraordinary. 130% additional studying higher level maths in 13 years, which coincides with when the bonus points of 25 came in.
Yes.
So people are they? You can tell me as a maths teacher, deciding to do higher level maths to grab the points, but they mightn't be a higher level maths student.
The big issue, I think, is if you're a fifth year student, you land in fifth year and you're straight away, you're in the CAO chase for points. You have to be doing honours maths because it's a free 25 points bonus, granted. If you get a H6 all the way to a H1, it's still 25 points. You can't afford not to be doing it. Now, to make it worse, if you like, or harder, especially in the last 5 years, and I think everything the ministers have done is correct. I think they've made it easier because COVID and all the rest. These students then are in a bind because they're finding it hard, but the experience of their brother or their cousin is, I passed. Mm-hmm. I got 11% in a mock, but I still got a H6 in the exam. So that's putting a huge pressure on the system. Also too, and I've had this conversation before, it's what I say is from Homer to Hawking, the spread of ability in a maths class is literally from good old Homer Simpson all the way to Stephen Hawking. It makes it really difficult for the teacher. So the top people aren't being catered for. Teachers are trying their best. They even have extra classes to try and get these weaker people across the line. The grinds industry, which was in overdrive in the last 15 years for sure, mm-hmm. has now accelerated to an even higher rate. I mean, I operate in that industry the whole time, but I've never seen anything like the demand in the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm.
That's maths teacher Brendan Gilday, who, along with the Irish Times' education editor Carl O'Brien, was talking about bonus points and grade deflation for this year's Leaving Cert on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. Over on the Ray Darcy Show, it was time to celebrate the year that Italy beat West Germany to win the World Cup.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to 1982. So what happened that year? There was a big snow. There was a big gotcha when Mike Murphy got Gay Byrne. We had our first leaders' debate on television before a general election. Great Britain went to war with the Falklands. And Ireland won the Triple Crown in sport.
Hey, sir. Well, I hadn't seen your face around town a while, so I greeted you with a knowing smile. When I saw that girl upon your arm, I knew she'd won your heart with a fatal charm. I said, soul boy, let's hit the town. I said, hey boy, and what's with the frown? But in return, all you could say was, hi, George, meet my fiancé.
George Michael and originally Wham! Young Guns Go For It. This was the biggest selling single in 1981 and still a hit in 1982. Human League, Don't You Want Me, Baby.
You were working as a waitress in a cocktail bar when I met you. I picked you out, I shook you up and turned you around, turned you into someone.
January of that year, heavy snowfall across Ireland, the heaviest for decades, resulted in traffic chaos, fuel shortages, food shortages, and the closure of schools and workplaces. This RT News report comes from Brendan O'Brien.
This was about the best and, in many places, the only way to travel today. The Army Air Corps' 5 helicopters made more than 20 Mersey missions since first proper morning light at 8 o'clock. Including flights to and from Waterford for 6 kidney dialysis patients, also to Cork, Monaghan, Cashel and Wicklow. One of the most frequent emergency problems involved pregnant women in labour. This was the scene at first light today and into the late afternoon. Cars still dug into the Nacedule carriageway snowdrifts. The biggest grievance heard around here was the need at this late stage for people to dig themselves out. More of the 270 people who spent last night at the nearby Air Motive factory got away today, leaving 50 still there, and that number is now down to 28, we've just heard. And these are some of the 400 people who spent last night at Houston Station, caused by these frozen points which just refused to move. Some eastern small towns are almost cut off from food supplies, and these people are queuing for bread in a Wicklow town. Scenes virtually unknown in Ireland this century.
Looking from a window above, it's like a story of love. Can you hear me? Came back only yesterday. I'm moving farther away. Won't you near me? All I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. And all I ever knew, only you. Sometimes when I think of her name, when it's only a game.
Brilliant Yazoo and Only You. Jimmy in Cork. I was born in 1982. 43 this year, Jimmy. My daughter Adele, born the weekend that Ireland won the Triple Crown. That's Carmel and Dublin. The airport in Dublin was closed for 2 to 3 days. Santry was covered 12 feet of snowdrifts and people working in the airport were stranded there. Wow. And this was a number one for Boy George and Culture Club. Together, here we go.
Pass the dutchie pan the left hand side. Pass the dutchie pan the left hand side. It a go bun.
Give me the music, make me jump and
run. Musical youth. Reggae was big in 1982. That's Eddie Grant. I married my beloved husband Peter on Friday, August 13th. The song Come On Eileen had everybody on the dance floor at our wedding, says Nolene. Probably dancing to this one as well.
I heat up, I can't cool down. You got me spinning round and round. Round and round and round it goes. Where it stops, nobody knows. Every time you call my name, I heat up like a burning flame. Burning flame, full of desire. Kiss me, baby, let the fire get higher.
The Steve Miller Band with Abracadabra from Ray Darcy's extensive celebration of the year we've come to know as 1982. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, we come to what Claire Byrne called the ultimate dilemma. You found the perfect pair of jeans, but what shoes should you pair with them? I mean, as dilemmas go, it's definitely up there. But whether it merits ultimate status or not, I guess will depend on what sort of view you have on life, the universe and everything. Anyway, if you're faced with this most intractable of dilemmas, fear not, because Claire has called on the help of personal and corporate consultant Aoife Duneken, aka the Style Bob, who should be able to guide us all in matters of denim versus footwear.
Oh my God, it's such a minefield, Claire. And, you know, they say shoes make or break an outfit, but with jeans, it's even more stark because we've got wide leg, bootleg, carrot. Hate to say the marmite of jeans, the
carrot.
Horseshoe jeans.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
But are they the same as barrel leg?
I'm wearing today. Very comfortable. We've got skinny, we've got straight leg. So the list goes on and on. And what happens is that so many people reject a new style of jean all because the shoes are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in a dressing room with people and they say, Aoife, no way. And then I'll show them a boot and it's transformational. I once myself had a bootleg jean cut to go with a runner. I ruined the jean, Claire, and never wore it again. So it's important to, it's all about balance. And not every runner goes with every jean. But if you love a runner and jean look, it's about the type of runner and the type of jean.
Well, now you say it's all about balance. So explain how that works.
Okay, so if we take a wide leg or a carried leg jean or wide leg, you know, you might say to yourself, gosh, that's very voluminous. But there's two things that make that really flattering on the body. So first of all, the ankle, by the way, is the most underrated part of the body. It's also probably our most slimmest part. So what I do, what I'm wearing today is with a wide leg jean, I crop it a little bit above the ankle and then I take a boot with a tight shaft, right? So this morning I'm walking my dog in my chunky boot. But you see, Claire, it's really
slim
tight
on the
ankle. So it kind of emulates that slimness at the ankle.
But can you see the top of the boot then?
No, you're just going to, you're literally showing the top of the ankle bone. So I get a lot of my kind of wide leg, either full length or I get them just chopped the top of the ankle.
So there's no gap between the jeans and the boot.
No,
you don't want
no
to see
sandwich.
That.
There's no sandwich, right? Now, that brings me to my next point, because what happens is that the reason someone says to me, well, if I'm wearing my shorter jeans and my white trainers, you know, how does that work? Because sometimes a white trainer and a sock doesn't look well.
Mm.
So that's why I love the elegant trainer. I don't have white trainers, Claire, because I love my ankles to be very warm. So I will take an elegant trainer with a wide leg jean, but I will add a darker sock.
Okay.
Add that darker sock.
So what you have there now, because you have these, you're showing them to us in the studio, but not everybody has the benefit of watching. So that is like, what would you get? A green and wine?
Green and burgundy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've added a dark grey sock,
mm-hmm.
right? And so what happens is that I'm showing my ankle bone. These go lovely and toasty up to my knees and it elongates my foot.
And what jeans are you wearing with that?
So I'm wearing a straight leg, slightly cropped jean. So
it's not bunching on the ankle or on, you don't
bunching,
want that.
Bunching, Claire, is not good.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a thing where, you know, like it's like a chunky trainer with a wide leg. It can work. But if there's, you've an awful lot of width then at the bottom, right?
You don't want that.
You don't want that, because what it does is that it shortens your legs. So, you know, although I'm 5'7", I'm all torso, a shorter leg. So I always look to elongate, use my shoes to elongate
mm-hmm.
my leg. So when I'm talking about the tighter shaft at the ankle, or that could be like a chunky boot here, or you see I've got my cowboy boot here that I wear in my bootleg jeans. It really lengthens the leg. So,
yeah.
That's
now,
important.
Before I come on to the shape of the boot, I just want to go back to the runner, because when I'm reading about this, sometimes I read about low profile runners. Is that what you have there? Because I don't know what that is.
I'm calling this my elegant technical runner.
Okay.
Yeah. That's
Which
what
means
it is.
That it doesn't have a bulky sole.
It's not chunky.
Mm.
Now, if you do like a chunky trainer, I'm holding a chunky trainer in my hand. I still personally prefer, if I was to pick one jean today, Claire, that goes with everything, I would pick a straight leg jean that's slightly cut above the ankle or just maybe at the ankle bone. Because then the chunky trainer, it's not puddling on top of it. It's when it's puddling on top, it's not a great look.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's that really long wide jean, I do love what we call the elegant trainer. So I kind of keep both. But the straight leg jean is great, because if you're somebody who loves, you know, like a jean in a boot, you can stick the straight leg jean in. If you love a heel with the jean, a heel looks very elegant with the straight leg jean, much more so than a skinny.
Mm-hmm. What about the kitten heels?
Love a kitten heel. So when I travel and I'm going out at night and I'm doing the jeans, a nice top look, I will take a kitten heel or a block heel. I love my silver for summer. So I can fly. I mean, I was in London recently and I was going out and I flew through the tube stations with my kit and heel and I was really comfortable. But a kit and heel, you could do a kit and heel boot or you can do a kit and heel shoe. And I just find it more comfortable. But the straight leg jean, it just looks really flattering and very modern.
Mm-hmm. So you can get away with that. Now, let's come back to these boots. And the reason I want to talk about the shape of the toe yes. is because with the flares, you're not allowed, now let me get this right,
yeah.
not allowed to wear a big round toe boot with flares. Is that right?
Do you know what happens is that the flares come down and you have two little shoes showing. That's basically, you kind of cut yourself.
The roundness of the flare and then the roundness of the boot. So
yeah.
that's not going to work. So you need a pointed boot.
You need a pointed boot. So either boot or something with kind of a long front on it here. So, you know, I've got my cowboy boot type here with the long front. So when I put my long flare jean over it, I've got a nice little point coming out. And it just looks really well. Again, it lengthens my leg and I just feel cool in it.
Yeah.
If I wear my kind of rounded toe here, this is a little bit more rounded, it just doesn't work, you know.
It's so complicated, isn't it?
It is so complicated. But if you were to take two things away this morning, buy your straight leg jean. When you're buying your chunky boot or your kind of other boot, think of the tight shaft.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing a session recently with six women and I told them about the sock boot. Very complicated sock boots, just tight on the ankle, and they said even
they're great boots, so they go with everything.
They go with everything, and all six of them actually came back to me and said, "Now we know how to wear those kind of wider crop jeans because it's all about the balance. It's the long toe puts the balance into a wider look.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bottom line.
You know the new trend for very wide jeans, like
yeah.
wide straight leg jeans. They were around in the '90s. You know people." Got them soaking wet in puddles and you ended up very uncomfortable. But
yeah.
they're back. So what do you do? What do you wear with those things?
So with those, I have a lot of clients that would be commuting to work with kind of wide legs and they want to wear trainers. So sometimes you can get a platform trainer if you want to change into heels, something like that. But again, the platform trainer, I know I'm reusing the word elegant again, still should be nice and long and elegant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I if you do a very big round toe chunky and again, the jean is puddling down, you're just adding width and it's not going to elongate the
yeah.
leg. And I can tell you, if anybody's listening that's got shorter legs, it's so important. Not, for example, you talk about the black suede boot. When I wear a darker jean, and I feel I want to elongate my leg, I look for a darker trainer or boot because it'll lengthen my leg and continue that line.
Mm.
And that's, I know it's complicated.
But maybe
that really
we shouldn't
helps.
Be wearing those very wide jeans then. Leave them for the teenagers.
No, Claire, you're going to look fabulous in those wide leg jeans.
Of course she is. More jeans and shoes advice than you can shake a stick at. And the ultimate dilemma, taken down a peg or two. Courtesy of Aoife Dunican and Claire Byrne this morning. And that's all I have for you on this rain-drenched edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead Mooney has a bigger, stronger, faster look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until Monday, thank you for listening and good luck.